Welcome to the podcast service of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. Visit us online at massclimateaction.net or friend us on Facebook.
Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of July 23rd, 2015. Today we're pleased to be joined today by our co-host, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing, D.R.?
Good. How are you doing?
Great. So, D.R., a couple of interesting things have come together in a recent report. I mean, everyone's heard about Egyptian mummies. Mummification process of drying things out so they last a long time. That can happen at high altitudes and cold, in the cold. So up on mountain peaks, there are people that have been buried for millennia and maybe not so many millennia that have died in the snow. And I saw a report this week that said these mummies are coming back out of the snow. Is that true?
Yes, it's something out of science fiction that's becoming science fact. There's a report by the McClatchy News Service discussing the melting of ice patches thanks to human-caused climate change, exposing, as they put it, relics, debris, and corpses that have hidden for decades, even millennia. And just you can just think of the morbid implications of all these things being exposed. They mentioned in one case a mummified climber that was exposed, a member of a Mexican expedition hit by an avalanche in November of 1959, and 56 years later, you can even see some remnants of their clothing, and it's just you start having flashbacks to Michael Jackson's Thriller video,
The picture that I saw was pretty gruesome of this human form climbing out of the snow.
But exactly.
I mean, it's kind of, I guess it's not unrelated to this famous thing about the 5,000-year-old man they found in the Alps, in the 1990s, right? The guy that sort of melted out of the snow, and it turns out that he was not quite a Neanderthal, but he dates that far back. And of course, the reason he's coming out of the snow is because the ice patches are melting back.
Exactly. It's
I guess it's the take-home lesson. Why is this an interesting thing to discuss, other than the fact that it proves pretty much, or certainly indicates, that the glaciers are melting and that human-caused climate change is real, and that it's going to do strange things that we hadn't really thought much about, right? We're going to get some surprises.
To put it in the most morbid terms possible, it's going to be sort of like Planet of the Living Dead. It's going to expose the dead while causing more death. The mortuary business, they're going to be loving this, but no one else will.
Well, but exactly. The other thing that, I mean, it's interesting because the discussion of mummies, of course, all the Egyptian mummies and many of these things are, the age of them is measured by carbon dating. Okay? And carbon dating is this kind of arcane process by which the following thing happens. When a living organism breathes, it breathes in a certain amount of carbon into its system from the outside world, and it's so that the mix of carbon in your body is the same as the atmosphere's. And of course, in the atmosphere, cosmic rays keep the balance of carbon-14 and carbon-15 more or less where it's been for millennia. So you have this balance in your body. When you die, all of a sudden, the radioactive parts of the carbon start to decay, and they can tell, basically measuring those radioactive elements, how long you've been dead, which is all great. Except that what we have done lately is to go and dig up 65 million year old carbon out of the ground, which has a much different sort of radioactive signature. We spew all that stuff up into the air. And so now the carbon dating clock isn't working as well. Right? And what they're saying is that the uncertainty in the prediction of a date for some object is now skewed to the order of 1,000 years because the carbon dioxide, the various radioactive isotopes of carbon dioxide that are in the air, because we've added so much CO2 that's been buried underground for so long, messes up this very important scientific process for dating things. So again, it's just another, to my mind, an example of the unanticipated consequences of global warming. Right? Now you can't date the mummies that you find a mummy in the ice pack. You can't figure out when it got put there because the carbon dating process doesn't work anymore.
It's causing a lot of carbon dating games, so to speak.
Well, and so then just to sort of top it off, but one other important piece of information that came up this week was that despite all of the talk for the last 10 or 15 years about the global warming hiatus, the pause, that we haven't had any warming in 17 years, it looks like 2015 is pretty much the hottest year on record so far, right?
Yes, there was a report, a number of different sources. There were one report in particular from Minnesota Public Radio discussing a recent report from NOAA noting that June 2015 was the hottest June on record, and that, quote, given the extremely warm months preceding June, 2015 is on track to have its warmest year on record following the record warm year of 2014. NOAA noted that every month in 2015 so far is ranked among the top four warmest in June, joined March and May as having warmth unsurpassed in records dating back to 1880. So for all the people who say that, well, you know, isn't it supposed to get warm every consecutive year? We're now going to have 2015 getting warmer than 2014, and if 2016 ends up getting warmer than 2015, and on, what are they going to say then?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I think it just shows that the statistics will ultimately prove that the scientific models are correct. Mm-hmm. Hiatus is over. This is a hot year, and in fact, I think that El Nino was supposed to be somehow a super El Nino this year, and I forget what the El Nino does, but it either makes us really, really hot or really, really rainy. But we got a big one coming this year, right?
There is some reports. I think there was a report in the Los Angeles Times a couple of days ago saying that the El Nino may be the only thing that could end the nearly 5-year-old drought that's been taking place in Los Angeles. So what happens if they go from, you know, too little rain to too much rain? I mean, there were just reports a couple of days ago about, you know, excessive rain causing a brewery partially collapse. It's sort of like Texas. You go from you know, they were praying for rain, and then those prayers were answered 4 years too late and in abundance, basically.
Yeah, so I mean, I guess the path we're on this week is, you know, lots of unanticipated consequences and terrible news about climate. And I guess just as the topper, it turns out that our favorite scientist, Mr. Jim Hansen, put out a new paper this past week. And for those of you who don't know, Jim Hansen is at this point an iconic figure in the world of climate activism. He is the scientist from NASA who first told Congress in 1988 that global warming was real. He has been the subject of vicious attacks. He recently has retired from NASA, but is still publishing papers. He has worked with Bill McKibben. I mean, he's basically his comments about the Keystone XL pipeline. You keep hearing that phrase about game over for climate if we have Keystone XL. Well, that was Jim Hansen's phrase in one of his papers. He's been arrested at the White House with McKibben, et cetera, et cetera. So quite a distinguished feature. So tell me, DR, what did Jim Hansen do this week, and why are we interested in it?
Well, there was a very, very well covered and somewhat controversial paper that's been released by Jim Hansen and 16 co-authors. And according to Eric Holthaus of Slate, the paper, quote, contends that glaciers in Greenland and Antarctica will melt 10 times faster than previous consensus estimates, resulting in sea level rise of at least 10 feet in as little as 50 years. And it was also noted
10 feet in 50 years is a huge amount that will be within our children's lifetime, right?
Exactly, and the resulting and basically the sort of the submerging of major cities. This study has been somewhat controversial because it's being published in a journal that essentially allows for a quote unquote public peer review process where scientists will be allowed to essentially weigh in. And obviously we hope that there are scientists that have credibility and not the scientists that are, to quote the radio host Mike Papantonio, the biostitutes and the pay of the polluters. So it'll be very interesting to see what the responses will be. Already some acclaimed climate scientists have weighed in. Some of them basically saying that, you know, that they'd have disagreements with aspects of methodology, but they also think that this will definitely be a significant conversation piece going into the Paris climate talks later on this year.
I think it's a very interesting strategy because scientific papers are typically submitted to a – so the way the scientific peer review process goes, so peer review is in quotation marks, it's a – You write a paper, you send it to a journal, the editor of the journal looks for scientists that you don't know in a similar field and sends your paper, not clandestinely, but, you know, independently to those people. They read your paper and they tell the editor whether they think your paper is worthy of publishing. And of course, nobody knows who is making the comments because it's supposed to be a sort of a unbiased process, right? And that's how the peer review process goes. But while that peer review process is underway, the paper's not published. Sounds like Hansen, what he's done is to put the paper out there and ask or allow for commentary from peers. And I would emphasize that in this circumstance, peers has to mean someone who is credentialed and has some idea about what climate science is and not just somebody with an opinion, right? That could be good for the whole process. And in fact, to see the scientists actually looking at each other's papers, making comments about it, and it exposes the honest give and take that scientists need to have and do have, and that's what produces the best paper. So at some level, I give Hansen credit for putting his paper up in a way that it would be reviewed publicly, and if people think he's incorrect, the scientists think he's incorrect, he'll find out about it. So good for him, huh?
Definitely. Obviously, you know, being a scientist, see the term public peer review, I wonder if this is going to turn to something like the Amazon.com review section, but hopefully it won't turn out that poorly.
Well, we can only hope. I mean, I agree with you that a public process like that invites, as John McCain called them, the crazies, right? Mm-hmm. It invites in people who only know how to turn their cap lock on and misspell words and try and make, but that's not a scientific peer review process. That's just somebody venting. So anyway, I guess Hansen's hope is that this discussion, and of course the substance of what he's saying is that the consequences of climate change are coming much faster than anybody anticipated. That is something that you'd like to have, what he wants to do is have his say and then let people shoot at it instead of keeping the whole thing under a barrel for 6 months while different people make comments on his paper through the sort of old-fashioned process.
Definitely.
So I guess, DR, here's the question I have. We've just been through this litany of the biblical plagues, right? We're going to have flooding. We're going to have mummies, zombified mummies stomping out of mountains. I mean, we have the hottest year on record. We're going to turn California from a desert into a mud bowl. All these terrible things from climate change. Mm-hmm. The question is, does that help people? You think all the people listening to this podcast, have we just depressed them and make them want to go back and watch Big Bang Theory? Or is it helpful to people to hear about these potentially depressing and devastating consequences?
Well, there's a lot of social scientists that says that people will tune out if they only hear, you know, negative worst case scenarios and don't hear of a way for such scenarios to be averted. Ben Adler of Grist, in his interview with Hansen, noted Hansen's support of, you know, international forms of carbon pricing to sort of avert the worst case scenarios we discussed last week, you know, the efficacy of cap and trade as a way of reducing emissions and thus reducing the worst case scenarios. So long, I guess you can argue that so long as people can be made to understand that these worst case scenarios can be avoided with the proper policies, then you won't have a mass tuning out. But if they only hear what the worst case scenarios are and don't hear a path to avoid those worst case scenarios, they may just say, the hell with it. Let me go back and watch my bread and circuses, so to speak.
I can only hope. I think there's a lot, you know, there's a lot of care that needs to be taken. I think people react differently to different messages. Some people will absorb the what's called the disaster frame, take it on board as a spirit of action. Other people are turned off by it. I personally am tired of the disaster frame. I want to know, you know, what are we going to do, right? I want to know the path forward, as you have put it. And I guess that's you know, we keep talking about carbon taxes and local grassroots organizing. Those are the paths out. But I hope we have not depressed people with our moralizing. I guess that's what I don't want is for climate hawks to come off as moralizing and preachy. Right, is that you want to say this is a moral issue that you should be concerned about, but not the sort of eat your peas kind of thing.
But you do have to explain what those worst case scenarios are, even if you get accused of, what was that nonsensical David Brooks phrase, excessive realism? You know what I mean? That's sort of thing.
Excessive. All right, yeah, excessive. Maybe that's what I've engaged in. Excessive realism, looking too hard at the possibilities.
Yes, dealing with facts and data. I mean, my God, can't have that.
So speaking of dealing with facts and data, there's one other thing, DR, that I wanted to bring up that has been troubling me for the last couple of days. Recently, I saw on TV a dashboard cam from the police car apprehension of a woman in Texas named Sandra Bland, who subsequently died in police custody. And when you look at the dashboard cam, right, it certainly seems a grotesque thing that has happened. I mean, I don't know what else to say about it. And I guess the question is, why would we want to discuss such a thing on a podcast that's ostensibly about climate? Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that that the forces working to create change in our society have to recognize each other as allies. Right? Mm-hmm. That the goal is the same. We may have slightly different techniques and areas of focus, but everyone is trying to make the world a better place in much the same way. And I think that climate hawks need to get on board with, I say Black Lives Matter, but I mean, I'm so far out of touch with most of this. I mean, this is, you know, this is an ongoing issue of racial inequality. Climate hawks need to recognize that, support the efforts to get rid of it, because ultimately even climate change goes to environmental justice, right? I mean, you come back, if communities are disempowered, then David Koch can dump all of his ash dust in the middle of Detroit, right? And no one has the power to stop him. So we all win. But I think that, well, and the other thing I think is that climate hawks, as we go forward, may be in a more and more confrontational aspect with police everywhere. And so it's in everyone's interest to make sure that the police behave properly in all these circumstances. Am I saying something crazy, or what's the what's your take on all this stuff?
No, not at all. And it's fascinating to see how these two issues intersect. through the body of, well, I shouldn't say body, but through the personage of the presidential candidate Martin O'Malley, who you may recall, several days ago he was at the Netroots Nation conference in Phoenix, and he was met with protesters from the Black Lives Matter movement, and he responded controversially, quote, "Black Lives Matter, White Lives Matter, All Lives Matter," unquote, which was seen as dismissive of the Black Lives Matter movement. Now, several days after that, O'Malley found himself in another controversy, this time a fake controversy drummed up by deniers, when he noted accurately that according to military officials, climate change played a role in the rise of ISIS, and he was attacked for that by the usual climate change denial crowd. Tying these two issues together, I guess you can make the argument that O'Malley should have said that, you know, yes, all lives matter, but all lives will be affected by the climate crisis if we don't resolve it, and that the climate crisis is one of those issues like racial justice that have to be elevated to the prominence, to the main event of political and cultural discussion, because, you know, police brutality may disproportionately affect people, but, you know, we will all be submerged, black, white, red, yellow, whatever, by rising sea levels and extreme storms. So it's fascinating how these two issues intersect through the obviously through the personage, mm-hmm. of those two controversial, yeah. one a real controversy, one a fake controversy, those two statements by Martin O'Malley.
Well, I think that this is a, you know, what's the curse about may you live in interesting times?
Exactly.
There's a lot going on nowadays, and I think the being forced to rethink your attitudes, and I think the Black Lives Matter movement is doing that. You know, it just sort of is like this reboot.
Mm-hmm.
In and of itself, it's a good thing, but it also opens, I guess we'd call it Overton's window, where all of a sudden the list of topics that can be discussed gets a little bit bigger, and mm-hmm. climate can be one of them, and vice versa. If we can talk about climate, we can talk about racial inequality, and if we can talk about racial inequality, we can talk about climate, because mm-hmm. everyone's thinking a little bit different. So anyway, that's my editorialization for the week, DR.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for listening to me. We'll tell most of our friends that they can check out links. Well, we'll tell all of our friends that they can listen to most of the links of what we talked about at the WordPress blog, massclimateaction.wordpress.com. Please leave us a message. You can get to us on Facebook at @massclimateaction. You can hear us on Stitcher. You can find us on iTunes. All those ways of finding the Climate Minute. So we'll close the way we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it is our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the United States put a price on carbon. So thank you very much, DR, for being here.
Thanks.
And we'll talk to you all again next week. Bye-bye.
Thanks for being with us. And until next time, be green.
Very cool.